Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Our very special guest today is actually our editor for one of our sister publications, The Gaming Economy, Matt Broughton. Welcome,
hello.
Matt. Hi, how's it going?
Not too shabby, after all the several internet connectivity issues this morning.
We've had
it
some...
seems to have calmed down, luckily.
Thank goodness. We've had some serious internet issues this morning, but now we're up and running. It's all going to be smooth sailing from here, right? Lindsay Rowntree over there in Walthamstow?
Well, I hope so. we shall see.
Yes, we certainly can't hear your laptop trying to take off in the background anymore, which is good.
Good. It hates me with a passion at the moment.
It's because you're trying to break it constantly.
Yeah, that's true. I am.
Doing too many things with it. Right. So first news story I wanted to discuss with you guys this morning was focusing on the EU and their plans to bring forward antitrust charges to Amazon. And it's widely anticipated. This has been talked about or sort of rumoured for quite some time, but it's widely anticipated that firm charges are going to be brought forward in the coming weeks, certainly before the summer recess. I put that in air quotes because it's kind of a weird summer. What's the recess going to look like? But anyway, before August is the tip. So this was widely covered in the US media last week because it's, focusing on, I suppose, Europe's approach to antitrust issues with respect to big tech companies, and in particular, this complaint against Amazon. It's going to be brought forward by Margaret Vestager, who certainly all of us that live in Europe, and I'm quite sure many people that work in relevant industries in the US are very familiar with her. She's the European Union's competition and digital chief. And she's the claims that she's going to be putting forward are likely to be focused on Amazon's dominant position in online retail and the fact that they use that to collect valuable data from competitors who sell products on their platform, and that then enables them to push their own products to buyers. The question being whether there's some competition rules being broken here and whether there is some new rules that need to be implemented in order to separate perhaps part of the business or create a scenario where Amazon can't, unfairly advantage themselves. So I'm interested to know what you guys think of this. We have spent a lot of time, definitely, in the last 12 to 18 months on the Mad Tech podcast and even periodically at ATS events talking about anti-competition with respect to big tech companies, how that's going to impact the broader ad tech industry, and what specifically it does for the sort of relationship, I suppose, between US tech giants and Europe and other countries. There's certainly other stories swirling around in the media at the moment about how other countries are trying to tackle the dominant and potentially anti-competitive nature of Google, Facebook, Amazon and Apple. But this particular story, as I said, is focusing on Amazon. Interested to know your points of view, whether in your opinion claims will really be brought forward in the coming weeks, because this has been something that's been talked about for a while. Are we actually going to see some firm action being brought forward? And what impact, if any, this is going to have on Amazon's business? Matt, let's start with you.
Well, I think in terms of action that the EU could bring forward, they have brought forward action previously against the likes of Google. They fined them €1.5 billion last year. But I think in terms of if they find that Amazon has broken the rules in this and has, acted in a anti-competitive way, then any action that is applied to them needs to be sort of strong enough to the point that it discourages them. So looking at that sort of Google example, it's €1.5 billion, which, for a government agency which may have to justify its funding more often than I have to justify getting myself a takeaway at the moment, it's probably a large amount of money, yes, but Google, last quarter they grew their revenues by 13% to something like 40 plus billion for a single quarter. 1.5 is not going to make any difference. So I think the action has to be strong in the sense that either if they continue down the fine routes to make them much more significant, or they start looking towards how are these sort of massive business units combined and how can, they be not necessarily broken apart, but made more open to allow that competition to take place.
Yeah, and they're really good points, Matt, because, you know, in a lot of the news media coverage, the focus was on, well, what would the European Union do? You know, will they issue fines or will they try to take some more, determined behaviour to disrupt the structure of the organisation? And I guess that's the point, is without some structural change, will this make any difference? What do you think, Lindsay? Is Margaret Vestager just looking for takeaway money here?
Yeah, I think she is. I totally agree with what Matt said. I think that we talked about this a few weeks ago with regards to Google and all of the investigations happening to the likes of GAFA in the US at the moment. And this whole concept of structural versus behavioural changes, and behavioural, i.e. fining Amazon a couple of billion, will not do anything. It will give the EU a bit more cashish, but it's not going to do anything else. It's literally just going to go, yep, look, see, we mean business. And we can charge these companies what we like. But if it's a smaller company, they will feel the hit, but a company like Amazon will not. And, you know, basically behavioural just means, you know, slap on the wrist, change your ways. It's not going to be enough versus structural. But then you have to question what power the EU have to actually be able to do anything structurally. Can they request divestiture? Can they request that Amazon has something like 140 own brands? We think of maybe Amazon as having Amazon Basics, but they have loads of brands, like from activewear, baby, kidswear, pet food, coffee, across every single aspect of Amazon, pretty much. There is an Amazon own brand that exists. And you wouldn't know it was an Amazon brand unless you dug deep into finding that out. So you could argue there's a lot of kind of wool being pulled over the eyes of the consumer that believe they're buying an independent brand, but actually they're buying an Amazon-owned brand. There could be something around that could be interesting to look into. But actually, I think that you're not going to be able to get Amazon to divest these individual brands that they have and almost make it church and state unless they can do that globally. Or you go down the India route where you say Amazon is not allowed to sell any of its own brand products on Amazon. It is only allowed to be a third-party marketplace. It is not allowed to be a retailer, not allowed to be a manufacturer as well. So maybe that is the route that we should be looking to go, the EU should be looking to go into as well. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, again, as I said, some of the media, you know, there's quite a broad range of media stories relating to this last week. And I think in one of them, Jeff Bezos came out to say that, you know, Amazon still overall only represents a very small percentage of the overall retail market in the US, for example. And I'm sure the statistics would look different in other regions. In fact, perhaps it would look even smaller. So it seems that partly this is to do with getting Amazon, well any action that the EU or any other regulatory authority was trying to enforce on Amazon that depended on getting them to admit that they were actually dominant in the market would be difficult, right? Because it's the first argument they're going to put forward is we've been successful, that doesn't mean that we've been dominant, and they'll use various accounting methods to prove that. So,
yeah, and the example, the article that you shared, Rachel, gave that, you know, the EU could decide to go on the route and say you are dominant in this particular area, e.g. books, and Amazon will try and spread that out and go, no, because we're not just a bookseller, we sell all this stuff, and across all this stuff, we aren't dominant, there's tons of people that are more dominant than us.
Yeah, exactly. And so you could imagine that regulators and Amazon will just get, you know, sort of swallowed in this he said, she said set of allegations about what the business is or isn't doing. So therefore, you can then see why regulators move to fines, because that seems to be an easier way to actually, you know, sort of get some action, get a result that benefits, government organisations and institutions that could use that money and reinvest that money elsewhere. But doesn't actually tackle the problem and then just brings
that's
us right
problem,
back to
the problem, though. Yeah. Is it really a solution? Like, okay, it gives the government money, but in terms of the ultimate goal is to try to create a fairer marketplace for consumers and for retailers and for manufacturers. And is finding Amazon a couple of billion going to bring them anywhere close to doing that?
Yeah.
No, and I think where, you know, Bezos's argument that it's a very small percentage of the overall retail market, I think that argument's a bit, to me, it's nonsensical, because they're not being challenged on their position within the overall retail marketplace. They're being challenged on their position as a platform and as a retailer within that platform. And if you look at sort of their market share in the US in terms of e-commerce, it's 44% when their nearest competitor, Walmart, is only like 7%. Mm. That is a dominant market position. And I don't think, you know, bringing in bricks and mortar retail and saying, actually, if you look at this, that you don't particularly as operate a comparator. In that space.
Yeah.
And I think where sort of the EU kind of has an opportunity in that it's a much more, you know, because of the, you know, various different countries within that, it's a much more fragmented market. The regulators actually have a chance to do something meaningful before Amazon can, you know, have that sort of same level of market share as they do in the US, as they do in Europe. And sort of, you know, little fines here and there aren't going to change that. And, you know, a few years down the line, if that's all they're going to be challenged with, they're going to have that same market share in e-commerce.
And it's interesting because there's a few issues swirling around together at the moment, right? There's the fact that we know that e-commerce is becoming a more and more commonplace way for people to buy goods, particularly as seen during lockdown as a result of the pandemic. And there's questions about whether that's going to be lasting behaviour change. Is this going to really boost a shift to e-commerce from sections of society that have never shopped that way before? And there's lots of predictions that it is going to be, it is representing lasting change. So then you're going to expect all e-commerce platforms to benefit from that. But isn't that going to only just further secure Amazon's dominant position, particularly in marketplaces where it's already doing well? Then there's also the point that I think it was last year sometime, you know, there was a number of US politicians talking about wanting to tackle not just Amazon, but also Facebook, Google and others on this notion of being a platform and also being a marketplace at the same time, and that there is, you know, an inherent anti-competition element to that. And then there's also the notion that, you know, there are other organisations, other government organisations and institutions around the world trying to tackle, you know, some of those big platforms on the basis of actual revenue achieved, and the idea being that creates an unfair advantage over where that revenue is generated and where that revenue comes from. So the examples I'm thinking about are the ACCC in Australia, who's their competition authority, trying to instigate a rule that says, you know, Facebook and Google can't just make revenue off news without returning a big chunk of that revenue back to the news media owners. I'm talking about advertising-related revenue off the back of news contents. And I guess that then leads us to this position of Amazon as well, developing, using their platform to develop data and, you know, I suppose customer loads of research points and customer buying signals and intentions in order to develop an entire suite of their own products. So, you know, it feels as though the EU's got an opportunity here to do a few things that might create a bit of a precedent for other countries and other authorities in dealing with Amazon, but also in dealing with some of these other companies, and in particular looking at that contradiction between having a technology platform and also having some kind of marketplace where people generate, or where that company in particular generates income. But is it going to lead anywhere? You know, I mean, I guess we have to wait to see exactly what the EU does. It feels like if anyone's got in the right position for this, it will be Margaret Vestager, because she's very passionate about anti-competition. But I don't know. Do you think this is going to have legs, Lindsay?
No. I think she's very, you're right, she's very passionate about anti-competition, but I think they've not really shown that they've done much to quell it yet. They've not done enough to actually be able to bring around any real results when it comes to anti-competitiveness. So I think Amazon is a great example of there being, now is the time to try something different. And there was an example, I wasn't really sure what the example was, but they tried something different, like an interim kind of quick fix to try and actually bring about structural changes to a company in a ruling last year, I think October. I forget what the details were, but it's proven they can do more than just fine companies. So if they can try and level that on Amazon, then it could be really interesting. But I feel, and apparently there are a lot of eyes on Margaret Vestager about this, because they're obviously all asked the same question, I feel it might just come down to a fine.
Mm. Yeah, because it's an easy result, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And interesting, because, you know, there's the anti-competitiveness aspect of it. There's that for brands, it's very much, you know, brands don't feel they get enough data from Amazon, but then they probably get more established brands that also work with bricks and mortar retailers probably get more data from them than they do from a retailer, which is like really, really much worse. But also it's very much, but they know, and they've been complaining for years that Amazon is taking their data and creating products that are the same as theirs and then making them appear higher in search results. So, but they know that if they don't appear on Amazon, they will lose out. It's better than ever, you know. And Amazon are very, very strict on them with encouraging them or forcing their hand somewhat to try and make it so that Amazon is the deliverer. So they use Amazon Fulfillment Center rather than deliver themselves. And if they do choose to deliver the products themselves, they have to abide by really strict rules around which couriers they can use, the different time frames in which they can send something. They have to be really, really strict. And Amazon are doing that for the good of the consumer, but also, I guess, along the line, just to convince them to ship it out to the Amazon Fulfillment Center so Amazon can take even more control of the entire supply chain. So if you look at it from, it's not just about what Amazon as a third-party seller taking as a marketplace and a retailer taking this data. It's Amazon trying to control the entire supply chain, which is also interesting, which makes it, you know, if you talk about dominance, makes it even more dominant.
Absolutely. And that makes it even more, sort of controlling and potentially anti-competitive because they will own every element of the supply chain. I don't know. Matt, final word?
I think sort of on the point of whether it will actually bring change, I really hope it does. But at the same time, I think kind of the actions that have been previously done and kind of the sort of global landscape and the fact that you've got America at the moment trying to be very insular and protecting its companies against any kind of scrutiny as it tries to sort of face up against China, I don't think that there's too much that can be done at this point.
Yeah, okay. All eyes on you, Margaret. Marguerite, please do something interesting. And, you know, Kieran's tried to engage her in conversation many times, direct tweets, all sorts of things. Wisely, she ignores him. But
I know he just doesn't bite.
No, I know he'd love to have a conversation with her. I think he's just jealous because the likes of Scott Galloway get to have conversations with her and she's got no idea who Kieran is. Anyway, moving on. Next story I wanted to chat with you guys about, and I'm very glad we've got Matt here because he's going to have an awful lot to say about this, was news that came out this week that AT&T are seeking a sale for their Warner Brothers gaming unit. So this is the gaming division of Warner Brothers. It's speculated that they're looking for a price tag of about $4 billion US dollars, which is just enormous, but that's the world of gaming potentially. For anyone who might not be familiar with their gaming titles, their popular titles include Mortal Kombat and Harry Potter titles. Potential interested parties are thought to be Electronic Arts, Activision Blizzard, and Take-Two. This is obviously potentially big news for the gaming industry, but also really interesting news from a business point of view when looking at AT&T as a business. It's thought that one of the reasons they're looking at selling the gaming division of Warner Brothers is because they're wanting to service somewhere in the region of $200 billion US dollars in debt. So I guess it makes sense to start divesting of your assets when you think you might be able to make a good return on them. But there's also speculation about how any sale would impact the intellectual property rights that they've got over some of the content embedded within the games, because many of the games are based off of intellectual property that they own, such as Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, as I already mentioned, Lego is another one. So what will that actually look like? Will they try to negotiate some form of ongoing revenue off the back of the intellectual property associated with those games? And, you know, what other gaming publishers in the marketplace have got deep enough pockets to potentially snap themselves up a bargain at $4 billion US dollars? Matt, our gaming guru, what do you think?
When I first sort of wrote up the story on the gaming economy, sort of the overriding thought I had in my mind was $4 billion just seems too high. Especially when, you know, you factor in the fact that Warner Brothers, it licenses rather than owns a lot of its flagship IP. In terms of Harry Potter, yes, they own a lot of the entertainment rights, but fundamentally the IP is owned by J.K. Rowling. And there's, you know, last year they had an awful lot of kerfuffle about whether they could bring out a film based on the Cursed Child IP that was in theatres, which was obviously run through Rowling. And it's just a bit of a mess there. And in terms of Lego, obviously the Lego company owns Lego. It's, you know, licensed out to Warner Brothers in terms of things such as films and games. But, you know, at the end of the day, they still own it. And if, you know, $4 billion for what is essentially a load of licensing deals, it's, you know, those contractual agreements may be in place, but those promises are coming from a company which is, you know, $165 billion in debt and may be under pressure to sell some of those licenses if that debt pile isn't alleviated within the next sort of 5 to 10 years or so. So I think just, you know, $4 billion for a promise that may be kind of, you know, out of date in 10, 15 years, it just seems too high. I've seen, you know, reports, I think in VentureBeat, that sort of a price of $2 billion dollars was being mooted, and that seems a bit more realistic to me, because there is, you know, at the end of the day, there is still a lot of strong IP in there. There was a Harry Potter role-playing game that was leaked back in 2018, I think, which is sort of still under the covers as such. If that is sort of used as a bargaining chip as part of the deal, and the new studio is able to kind of bring that game out and make it as good as its obvious appeal could be, then that's an obvious money printer right there. So it's kind of, there's good points and bad points about the deal, but I think a $2 billion price tag would be far more realistic.
And to what extent do you think that the sort of rumoured interested parties will be thinking, yeah, great, I want to snap this up? How attractive is this to other gaming developers and studios?
This is quite interesting, because I think there's sort of a lot of different areas you could go in with the acquisition. There's a lot of opportunity, like Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment, it hasn't really done too much in mobile at the moment, and I think there's a huge opportunity there. They've, I think just this week, launched a partnership with NetEase for a mobile game based on the Lord of the Rings franchise. So sort of doing that kind of thing more often could bring the sort of mobile element into play. And I think Activision Blizzard could lean sort of very strongly on that, given their, you know, expertise across
mobile,
console,
heritage,
PC, and obviously mobile. EA, I'm not, again, that could probably feed in more towards the Harry Potter IP side of it, and also the Lego games, because I think that's quite comparable to the work they've done with the Star Wars franchise. And Take-Two, I think they're kind of the generalist in the corner as such. They could kind of take it wherever avenue they want. But also, I think something that hasn't been mentioned is the likes of Tencent, who have for a while been looking very strongly at getting into more Western IP. And, you know, you've got Harry Potter, you've got Lego, you've got DC, you've got Mortal Kombat. That is just, you know, for them and what they've been shouting about as their business strategy, I wouldn't be surprised if they sneak in with a deal there.
That would be really interesting, wouldn't it? That would be really interesting. And you kind of, I mean, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I sort of imagine that Tencent might have the pockets for it as well. You know, if it was really important to them, like you say, to acquire something with a very strong westernized audience, then maybe they'll be prepared to throw a lot of cash at it and outbid others. Who knows? Lindsay, have you got any inside info for us?
No, I've got nothing to share with you, I'm afraid. Nothing of any interest. But it's funny, I'm pleased you mentioned China, Matt, because I wrote China down here in big letters. Like, why are these all American companies?
China.
But yeah, I think there's a massive opportunity there. And Matt, you're absolutely right. Like, as you say, these companies, the likes of Tencent, have been looking to invest in Western companies and do invest heavily in Western companies. And this would be a great opportunity for them to especially get rights that are so popular in the Asian markets as well. And I think if you look at the likes of Take-Two, who I wasn't really that aware of, as I'm not the gaming expert that you are, Matt, but you probably, if you don't know who Take-Two are like me, They own Rockstar. So Rockstar is their publisher, their developer house, basically. And I didn't realise that Rockstar actually executive produced the brilliant film Football Factory, the classic Danny Dyer, Tamer Hassan duo from like the early 2000s.
Danny Dyer name drop.
Well, absolutely. You can't get by without name dropping Danny Dyer. So they are, as Matt has already kind of described them as, they're a bit sort of generalist, but jack of all trades. They cover everything, but they don't, from what I can tell, they do have experience in licensing, like the likes of, they've got MLB and NBA. But they've also, so it's more sports, a bit like EA have got with FIFA. But they don't have much experience in mobile, but they do have experience in producing games for other platforms such as Stadia, and which is coming next year, and Oculus Rift. But yeah, Activision Blizzard, definitely they are on the game, on the mobile front, absolutely, because they toiled away for a long, long time to make Call of Duty as good a mobile game as it is. And it took a lot for them to build that, and they wanted to make it right, particularly because they have, especially with the acquisition of King and the like, they've got this massive mobile heritage they have to make sure they play up to. So that could be interesting from a mobile perspective. EA, also very good on mobile, but they have more of the console heritage. But again, as Matt said, they've got the experience already with the licensing and the franchises. So actually any of them could, I think Take-Two for me seems the least likely, but Activision and EA could battle it out. One could bring more benefits than the other. There's probably no kind of, I think I agree with you, Matt, that of those three, EA is probably the most suited based on its experience more generally. But yeah, I think there's massive opportunity in Asia there. But yeah, I think that it's interesting that it's not really being that much explored, but it probably is on the sidelines. They'll just, as you say, come in last minute for a cheeky sideswipe.
Yeah, and bear in mind, NetEase, they recently did a huge secondary listing in Hong Kong, so they've got, you know, a few billion to play with now. They might be sort of, we'll see how this partnership works on this Lord of the Rings game, see how that goes. And then towards the end of negotiating an agreement, say, actually, that worked really well from us. We got everything we wanted from that. Let's bring in all your other IP. Here's a few billion dollars.
Yeah. I wonder as well, because on that point about the second listing on the Hong Kong market, I wonder about what AT&T's play is here. Like, how desperate are they to divest Warner Gaming? Do they want to enter? If they are insistent on keeping the IP as in the way that they own it, as you mentioned, Matt, they don't really own it, but they're a middleman to it. How interested would they be keeping it if they were to then do a deal with something like a Chinese company? Would that then make things very, very complicated? It just sounds really messy, really. Yeah. Is it all too messy?
Hugely. And I'm also, you know, wondering, you know, it would depend on looking at the assets, you know, that AT&T have got at their disposal. But would you really be getting rid of gaming at the moment? Like, it's just one of the biggest growing fields and industries going.
And it's been sort of one of these that has just been huge, well, broadly resilient within COVID-19. And sort of looking at, you know, WarnerMedia's other you know, bits and bobs, they've had to kind of consolidate HBO Go and HBO Max and however many HBO things they've got, just to try and have one kind of, you know, this is the kind of streaming platform we're going forward. But as, you know, as we've been covering several times before, the streaming market is hugely, hugely competitive, and I'm not sure where they can get that angle from, given that, you know, Game of Thrones, which was their flagship for, you know, many, many years, you know, the ending of that in terms of the fans' eyes went down the toilet. So it's, you know, it's difficult to see, you know, I think they've kind of been hamstrung by this agreement with, I think it's, you know, Elliott Shareholding Group or something along those lines, the activist investor, where they've reportedly signed a deal to divest themselves of, you know, 10 billion. But I think sort of targeting gaming for that, whereas, when, as we've said, it's been broadly resilient, it just seems an odd approach to me. And sort of, you know, whereas, yeah, getting rid of $10 billion worth of debt, happy days, that's a good recommendation for anyone. But compared to a debt portfolio of $165 billion, it's a bit of a fart in a hurricane.
Absolutely. Fart in a hurricane. Brilliant.
I think it's this classic. It's this classic telco approach to things. They thought they want to and they should kind of own the world, and they go and get all this stuff, and then they go, oh, what do we do with it now? And it feels like there's still too much of it. There's still too much legacy operations and legacy processes in AT&T. Because if you look at what happened with what's going on with Xander as well, is interesting, and the departure of Brian Lesser, and a lot of the rumors swirling around about what happened there. And actually, it was down, you know, no one really knows what's going on, but it could have been down to the way that AT&T wanted to handle their approach to ad tech and approach to advertising data more generally. And you sort of think that is it old school AT&T that's still calling the shots here? And they aren't really seeing the opportunity that exists with all this new up and coming stuff, like having to merge their two streaming platforms, possibly sell DirecTV, which is one of their skinny bundles that they have as access, another sort of streaming platform, divest their gaming arm. It just seems, but they're focusing heavily on the assets and the rights and the movie franchises. It seems like they're getting rid of the good stuff too soon.
Mm. And particularly at a moment, as we've just discussed, which doesn't feel like the right time to be divesting of a gaming asset. You know, surely you ought to be thinking about what potential revenue that could be bringing in down the future. Isn't that an area of the business that's ripe for enormous growth if you get it right? So it either suggests that they're in a financial situation that is, that's got a lot of pressure for results right now. Like you said, Matt, perhaps it's connected to investors. Or they quite literally, as you say, Lindsay, are just struggling with the ways in which they organise their business, and they're going for very traditional ways of getting rid of debt and prioritising other parts of the business that they either feel more familiar with or just feel more established. And you know, we shouldn't skip over that point that you made, Matt, that their ownership of the intellectual property relating to some of that content is sketchy, loose, you know. There's nothing to say that they could, you know, I imagine it would be very difficult for them to argue that they should be getting continued revenue off the back of IP that they actually don't literally own themselves. So, yeah, anyway.
Exactly, especially when, so sort of using the Harry Potter example again, you know, J.K. Rowling has historically been very sort of protective of the IP, as she should be, and in terms of sort of commercial partnerships that have previously been fostered with the IP, they've been kind of limited by that. You know, would she sign off on that IP being not sold but licensed out to a Chinese company, for example? That's not 100% certain. And if, you know, as I said, if AT&T come under more pressure and have to sell off, you know, say they have to sell off DC or have to sell off, you know, they have to go, right, we can no longer afford the licensing agreement to, say, you know, Lego movies and sort of, you know, entertainment that ties into that. So it's just sort of, it's on shaky ground, really.
Mm. Like we said, ripe for Tencent, really, to just be observing from afar and then swooping in just at the last minute. Yeah, that's going to be a really interesting one to watch. Okay, third news story, bringing us back to the world of advertising and marketing. Brian Weezer of Group M, previously an analyst working with Pivotal Research, but still in an business analytical role at Group M, releases really interesting and valuable mid-year forecasts, which talk about what he thinks is going to happen with the rest of this year and what he thinks is going to happen at the beginning of next year. He's released three summaries, which have been widely shared amongst industry luminaries and press on the UK advertising market, the US advertising market, and the French advertising market. I'm going to principally talk about some of the findings that he's drawn out of the UK report that he published earlier on this week, because they're pretty interesting. So he's making a couple of assumptions in his position, or in his conclusions of where he thinks the industry is at the moment, where it's going to go in the next 12 months from here. And that is that there will be some kind of a vaccine or treatment that will stem the sort of spiraling nature of the pandemic and bring it to some form of a close. And will return life back to an environment where people can move around and interact with more ease, and lockdown measures are continually released. And that therefore also assumes that big events such as the Olympics will go ahead in 2021. So what the headlines tell us from his report is that the overall advertising market in the UK is set to decline by 13% this year, but make a recovery of 13% next year, so grow by 13% in 2021. What's interesting about this is he's drawn the comparison with the rate at which, or with the percentage at which, the market declined in 2009 around the time of the global financial crisis, which was 12% overall. And it was quite remarkable to see that the sort of forecast decline in the market is only one percentage point higher in this, you know, unprecedented shit show, quite frankly, that we've all been living through over the last few months. He mentioned specifically that digital advertising is going to decline by 8% this year and grow by 11% next year. E-commerce is going to see a big boost. We mentioned that earlier on with some of our conversation around Amazon. And he's predicting a 44% increase in ad revenue related to e-com this year and an enormous 66% increase next year. So, you know, obviously potentially fueled by behaviour change as a result of lockdown and the pandemic. TV is set to decline by 15% this year and grow by 13% next year. And that includes a decline in linear by 17% this year, but making a recovery due to cancelled or postponed advertising engagements relating to things such as the Olympic and other sporting events that haven't gone ahead this year. Out of home is the part of the advertising industry that's looking to experience the biggest decline by 35% this year, but set to grow by 23% next year. Excuse me. And that's going to be helped by the continued digitisation of this channel. So where he sees growth, he also sees an opportunity, obviously, for programmatic and data-driven advertising tools in an out-of-home environment, digitised out-of-home environment. He also talks about audio falling by 16% this year and growing again by 14% next year, and that this might be a channel that marketers flock to in an environment where they're seeing low cost and sort of low risk in a relatively stable channel where things haven't changed significantly during this period of lockdown. Of course, there's been much discussion about how maybe people aren't listening to podcasts and maybe people aren't listening to audio in the same way that they would be if they're not commuting. But I think what's also been found is that actually there's a whole lot of new audiences flocking to audio channels that haven't beforehand because their behaviour has changed over the last couple of months as well. So I'm interested in your views on this. It sort of paints a picture of, you know, V-shaped recovery, I suppose. You know, there isn't that many dramatically different statistics from this year to the next year in terms of decline and then recovery. But of course, this is all predicated on things kind of settling down over the coming 6 months and that continuing into next year. What do you think, Matt?
I think a lot of his predictions are optimistic. I wouldn't necessarily say overly optimistic at this point, but, you know, given that the fact that, you know, the contraction has been caused by, you know, lockdown restrictions, et cetera, rather than issues, you know, with the fundamental underlying economic framework, such as the, you know, when the US mortgage market went to absolute shit in 2008, 2009. Mm. So, you know, it's, in theory, it's more than reasonable to suggest that there will be this bounce back. But I think there's a lot of stuff factored in that there's, you know, no way you could predict what will happen. And I think there was one line in the report which said, of course, the vast majority of media consumption growth levels will return to pre-lockdown levels. And I don't know how you can honestly say that at this point. Yes, you know, the Olympics may go ahead. Yes, lockdown and social distancing measures may, you know, be lessened as the months go on. But will everything return to normal instantly? Probably not. You know, global travel may not return to the levels it was until 2022, 2023. You know, offices may be like, no, we don't, we're not, you know, we can work from home during this time. We don't need to go back to these, you know, massive inner city offices and spend all that money. So that, you know, affects audio and people traveling to and from work. That affects these sort of, you know, inner city areas where digital out of home is primarily based. So I think there's just so many different factors that you can't accurately predict it at the moment.
Mm. What do you think, Lindsay?
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of what Matt said. I mean, there's a lot of information in there, there's a lot to unpick, but essentially what Brian is predicting is that this year will be a write-off and we will get back to around 2019 levels in 2021. So we have to basically pretend this year doesn't exist. And that might be the case that I mean, Brian is an incredibly intelligent man and has many numbers on his side to look at this. But I think that it's if we do get there, it's how we get there. And I think that my worry, and we talked about this particularly, you know, from the TV upfront perspective when we had Maria from Amobi on a few weeks ago, you know, what does the future of the upfront look like? Will people want to invest in the Olympics like 3 years in advance? Will people want to invest in sports 6 months in advance? Will they be willing to put that money behind things in the long term? And I think that the brand's long-term commitment to spending might change. And I feel like it probably should change. I feel like there's a lot of brands out there that are, you know, it's been a really good time for them to reflect and question how they spend, where they spend, what they do with their money, which markets, which channels, which audiences. And I think that not only do we have to question the long-term commitment to brand spending, but also there's a lot of speculation about whether things will return to normal or not, or will there be a new normal that is completely different from the old normal? And how does that impact consumer behavior? And will a brand understand how they can, you know, I'm thinking about things like how brands have been looking much more outcomes-based advertising versus just branding and brand awareness. And outcomes requires a lot of understanding of your customer and your potential customers that are similar to that customer and your potential modeling and long-term modeling and looking beyond like a 30-day window, but looking more like a 3, 6, 9, 12-month window, a bit like, you know, what insurance companies can do. Can they do that if they aren't sure how a consumer is going to act in this new world? And that, I think, is where brands will have to completely remodel their algorithms, completely remodel what a customer looks like and what the loyalty of a customer looks like. And I think that if this rebound happens, where will the budget go and how will that budget be used? I think it will be used a lot more strategically than a kind of like spray and pray approach that many have been used in the past. And there's been, you know, if you think about some big brands, they might have a budget at the start of the year of, for example, 10 million, and they might get to Q4 and haven't spent much of it. So they then go, we need to spend this money now. If we don't spend it, we lose it. Will that still be an attitude that the procurement and the finance teams will have in big brands? If there's still 3 million left and we haven't spent it, let's get it out quickly. We go, okay, we need to reinvest this somewhere more useful. And will it mean that brands internally will be more cohesive in their communication around where money goes rather than here's your budget, do what you like with it, here's your budget, do what you like with it? And I think it'd be interesting to look at that and how they tie that in with what their customer looks like.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you're right, Lindsay. There's going to be a lot more sort of need and desire for some quite serious data and analytics focusing on customers, you know, like you say, what they're doing and what they might likely to be doing next, because that's what's going to be required in an environment where you just don't have, you know, sort of unified behaviours, right? You know, if we'd faced something like this, even say back in the early 2000s, even around sort of 2005, 2006, you know, we weren't watching streamed television, smartphone penetration was at the very early days.
There was no social media.
Facebook
hadn't even launched then.
Exactly.
Big up, it Bebo.
Bebo, yeah.
Were you on Bebo, Matt?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You could customize your profile and everything. I think I had mine with a black background with neon green writing because I was that cool and hip.
Oh my god!
nice. So back in the world of Bebo, it was probably easier to sort of broadcast communications and in a sense to a sort of mass market environment, and you just didn't have the same tools available, obviously, to follow your customers around and work out what they were going to do next. So that might have been an environment where you know, there could have been some advantages to sort of capturing an audience in a sort of much broader context, whereas that's not how advertising and marketing works anymore. And we know that's not how advertising and marketing works anymore because we work in the business of digital advertising and marketing technology. And so we've been talking about this for years, and it feels like the set of circumstances we now find ourselves in have sort of propelled us much more quickly to that point where actually data tools, technology tools are going to be the thing that differentiates you from the rest of your competitors. What I think is also interesting here, though, is that none of Brian's reports that I read through really took into account the notion that in some markets, certainly in a lot of European markets, and I'd argue in the US as well, you know, we were reaching an environment, and particularly here in the UK, we were reaching an environment where we were almost at maximum employment before the pandemic came along. So unemployment was at, you know, historically low levels. And from an economic point of view, we'd been going through period on period on period on period of growth. There was lots of indications to suggest that a economic slowdown slash recession was around the corner anyway, without the pandemic getting in the way. And that's now propelled us to a point where, you know, some form of economic downturn, which we're currently experiencing anyway, is absolutely guaranteed. But is there still going to be a recession underlining all of that and or running off the back of it? And by that, I mean, there will have been, in this set of economic circumstances that existed before the pandemic, a lot of businesses that were probably on the brink anyway, and that have either been propelled more quickly into bankruptcy or are being propped up artificially for the time being, but are likely to experience significant downturns, which might result in redundancies or bankruptcy, which will result in closing altogether. And to what extent are we capturing any of that at the moment? I mean, it might not be possible to, but the sort of the rebound, the other side of the V that is being keenly predicted everywhere, might just not reach the heights that everyone's expecting because we're also in the middle of a recession.
I agree with that. What I think everyone's forgetting because of the pandemic is that actually Q1 was a struggle for many industries. Q1 was nowhere near as buoyant as people expected it to be. And everyone's kind of just written that off and forgotten about it completely and gone, oh, the pandemic's ruined us. But actually, as you say, Rachel, maybe this downturn was actually already in motion and the pandemic has just sped it up.
Exactly. And I guess we're not going to know, obviously, until we start to get later, you know, to sort of further down the year and into next year. And I suppose the other thing is that we were certainly tempted at the beginning of this pandemic period to look to Asia for some clues as to what's going to happen next, to look to China for some indication of, you know, from an economic point of view and from a business point of view, for some indications of who recovered quickly and what that recovery looked like. But it's really interesting that this week we've seen news come out of Beijing that actually they've seen a spike in cases, so they've had to lock things down again. It looks like from the news reports I was reading today that looks to be getting things under control and their daily reporting of cases has gone down. But, I mean, it's still probably very early in this mini spike to know which direction that's going to go in. So I don't think there's any, you know, there's no tea leaves out there that's really that we can base any predictions on at the moment. I mean, you know, Brian can obviously base his predictions on a lot of financial modelling and much experience working in investment banking and finance. But for the rest of us, it's difficult to believe what you read anywhere at the moment. I don't know.
Yeah, I think what it does show, of course, is that because in the US, 2020 will not be quite as impacted purely down to political advertising and the billions of dollars that go into political advertising, which showed you that's one industry that's not going anywhere. And so politics is going to be the death and the saviour of the US all at once, all of the things. But yes, it's interesting that is what will keep US kind of largely afloat or like not flat, but reduce the decline significantly if you forget the underlying bit and look at the political spending. But the rest of us haven't really got that to fall back on. And I wonder that the inferences that Brian's made over individual channels, for example, print will see a boost again in 2021 in the UK, but it will see a massive decline in the US as they go, you know what, print is not working for us. Let's reduce our operations on that and go somewhere else instead. But why are we, I don't know enough about the print industry, to be fair. Mm. Why are we in the print industry going to see an uptick again where the US won't? Kind of what's the difference in terms of how we're viewing the print market? And then out of home as well, France will see France is doing very well on the digital front. And they'll see a stronger uptick in 2021 in the digital aspect of things, whereas the US largely won't, because they're still quite archaic when it comes to out of home. So it is interesting to see the different nuances. But I think we're all going to experience the one thing that connects every single market is that nobody knows.
No, exactly. And you're totally right about all of that, Lindsay. There are these nuanced factors in each individual market that's making things look a little bit differently. It'd be great to dig behind that and understand a bit more. The other thing is what we've got on our hands here in the UK is Brexit. You know, we still haven't got trade negotiations and deals signed off.
I forgot about Brexit.
Exactly.
Totally.
Amazing. What kind of a year are we living where suddenly we forget about Brexit? That just goes to show. And I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed, Matt very helpfully shared on our ExchangeWire Telegram group yesterday, a tremendously entertaining video from our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, introducing the start of trade negotiations with Australia by talking about how magnificent it will be once a trade agreement is negotiated, because we might be able to get a better, more streamlined supply of Tim Tams.
It was just so ridiculous. Like, 2020 has been an absolute roller coaster of a weird, weird dystopian world, and it's got to the point where now the British Prime Minister is waving a packet of Tim Tams around going, for too long the British people have been denied their right to these delicious, he even said the brand name, I can't remember it off the top.
Arnott's.
These delicious Arnott's Tim Tams at reasonable export prices. And it's like, what is happening?
But they're like penguins. So
no,
I don't really
now,
think
Lindsay,
that many Tim Tams, because they are that similar to a penguin.
Shut that conversation down right now. We all, and this means no Tim Tams for you at all, whether they are provided by the Prime Minister or me exporting them directly, importing them rather, I should say. But I mean, I have to say, this is one point that I do agree with Boris Johnson on, which is Tim Tams are too expensive to be purchased in this country. So it would be really good if we could get on top of that. But I'd much rather that he prioritise some other things in between now and then, to be frank.
Well, he could fly his newly painted plane over to pick them up for us, fill it up with Tim Tams, bring them over.
I mean, I wouldn't say no at this stage.
Land of hope and glory, blaring out from the plane as the first Tim Tams land on British soil. What an inspiring moment that'll be when the country's falling to shit.
£1 million well spent.
Oh, yes. I think that's actually a really good place to probably pull this conversation to a close, because ultimately, what else do we talk about? We're a bit concerned about the state of marketing and advertising, but we might get some Tim Tams. That's good news. Matt, any final words from you on that?
Basically, just the sort of as it was going through Brian's report, the one thing that wasn't mentioned, gaming.
Yes, good point. How did we miss that?
We've been talking, as Lindsay said, tech and tools will be what will be the key maybe the key differentiator going forward. And there are a lot of fantastic, innovative, advertising technology and other tech platforms within gaming that brands should be looking towards to partner with. And as we said earlier, it is one of the generally, obviously, there's ups and downs in any industry, but it's one that has been so far and probably will be most resilient to this. So if they're they still need to sell their products, and I think gaming is probably the best place to look towards to do that.
100%, and that is sort of a helpful way to start the sort of final part of the podcast, which is as is usually the trend to discuss what our guest is getting up to. Of course, you are immersing yourself in the world of gaming, writing some fantastic pieces for the gaming economy. But I guess that would be one of the first things that I wanted to ask you is, to what extent, from your experience of writing about gaming, do you feel that conversations about advertising are becoming a bit more mainstream in a gaming environment, gaming context?
I definitely think they are, because there's sort of when I first started writing for the gaming economy, and obviously where I'd be just sort of looking into it on just out of interest, there was always this tired cliche of gamers are not just the teenage boys in their basement, they are actually everyone. And I think people are now actually, that's not just a phrase anymore. People are starting to get that and apply that. And I think in terms of advertising, just yesterday you've had like AdMix raising $7 million. there's, you know, Bidstack, and, you know, they've been performing, you know, really well over the last few quarters. So I think, you know, brands and agencies are starting to get that. And I think the conversation you guys had on this podcast with Mindshare, that was really sort of exciting to see how they're embracing gaming, and they're going, yes, our, you know, the clients that embrace gaming, those are the ones we tend to go to first, because they, you know, they know how much of an interesting and sort of useful channel it can be for advertising. So I think it's, you know, the attention's on the sector now, because obviously where traditional entertainment and sports has been kind of sidelined throughout COVID. And I think that attention is going to be resilient and stay in gaming.
And do you think that's also going to sort of spill over into, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the streaming wars in a TV context. Do you think it's going to sort of spill over into the competitive nature, not just of gaming developers, but also in terms of the ways in which people are building their gaming businesses out and building their revenue models? Do you think we're going to start to see some hot competition, basically, between people, not just with respect to their titles, but with respect to the full spectrum of kind of monetization opportunities, which could be basic advertising and advertising placements, but also, product placements, sponsorship, and not just in an esports environment, because obviously sponsorship is quite big in esports as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you guys talked about it when Zynga acquired Peak, that could be, you know, it's likely to be a signal of them building out sort of a full scale advertising business on top of their, you know, now particularly broad range of high revenue gaining mobile games. And in terms of obviously esports, it's kind of the easiest avenue in for brands, because it's obviously very similar to traditional sporting books. But you know, you've got the likes of Riot Games now adding in-game banners to League of Legends competitions. There's been a hell of a lot of work done in terms of streaming broadcasts, the likes of Twitch, and there's a lot of sort of third-party platforms as well. Boom.tv, we interviewed them, I think it was last week, when they raised, I think, about $10 million. So I think there's just so much opportunity within the gaming industry, and it's a particularly broad industry as well. So there's plenty of different avenues that brands and investors can explore.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess it's going to be also seen as much more of an entertainment channel, than a sort of traditional, I don't know, gaming toy play channel, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Like, it includes all of those things, but it's also an enormous entertainment vehicle. And I think that's definitely what we've seen during the pandemic, with the level of interest in some of the online events and tournaments that are just getting record numbers of people wanting to tune in. I know they've been growing in popularity anyway, but it feels like more of an audience has been pushed towards those in an environment where you can't go out to things in person.
Absolutely. Like, if you just look at Fortnite, for example. They've run concerts within the game. They've, run film trailers within the game. They did a, in-game event earlier on this week, which was so oversubscribed that they had millions and millions of users spilling over into Twitch, onto YouTube, just to watch what was going on. And there is just so much user engagement with these platforms as they are becoming. In terms of esports, even though a lot of, most of the in-person events have been cancelled, look at what motorsports are doing. Their, sort of involvement within esports has shot up massively. You've got the leading gamers now regularly competing in esports competitions. And it's sort of a really exciting time for the industry to see those crossovers and see how those platforms can be built out.
Lindsay, any thoughts from you?
I think what's interesting from what you're saying, Matt, obviously when we talk about gaming from an advertiser perspective and from an exchange app perspective almost, we often refer to it as kind of the in-app opportunity and the mobile gaming opportunity. But actually, it's remembering that there is this massive breadth to gaming. And we talked a few weeks ago on the podcast about BMW investing in esports. Obviously, you mentioned BidStack there as well, kind of looking at things like product placement within console games. There is so much opportunity within gaming that's beyond what we're referring to as the explosion of mobile in-app. And I think that's what obviously is interesting when speaking to you, Matt, because as a gamer yourself, you're talking about, and not just from a kind of somebody playing Candy Crush on the tube type perspective, but the massive, massive gaming audience that exists. So it's interesting to hear about life outside of in-app gaming and the advertising opportunity, but the opportunity for not just brands to engage, but anybody to engage more generally.
Yeah, and I think where sort of one kind of good bellwether for how the industry as a whole is doing is the investment within that. Obviously, you know, my role as editor has been looking quite closely at that investment. We've got the TG index, which we're using to track investment. And obviously, we've been talking about, in terms of digital advertising, you know, how there may be, you know, turndowns in out-of-home audio, etc. In gaming, the investment, looking at sort of third-party statistics as well, it's gone up around 10 times from quarter one to quarter two. And I think that just sort of shows how, you know, if investors are excited by it, then that's obviously going to bring, you know, more money into the industry and help grow out those platforms, which, as I've said, will become hugely interesting and exciting from the advertising point of view, from the gaming point of view, from the wider digital entertainment point of view as well. So it's just sort of a really exciting and interesting space, really.
Amazing. Definitely exciting times. I'm going to wrap this up because we've rabbited on for nearly an hour. Sorry, listeners. Hope you found it interesting. I certainly did. It was a delight to have you as our guest for a change, Matt.
It was an absolute pleasure.
And fantastic to hear about the world of gaming. Thank you very much, Lindsay, over there in Walthamstow, keeping it real.
Thank you. Of course.
And that was
E17 style.
Oh, yeah. What was it? They were E17. I want to say Boyhood Hood, but that's totally
wrong.
Different.
Wrong they were continent. E17, and then they were E17.
Oh, because yeah. East was too difficult.
I think so.
Yeah.
That's what we are. E17,
anyway,
massive.
For listeners that have got no idea what we're talking about, you'll just have to Google that one, E17. All right, that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.